Hello and welcome to Didactic Mind, episode 2. I am the Didact, your host, and a very warm welcome to all of my listeners, regular readers from the blog, anyone who's stumbled across this, by going through SoundCloud itself, those of you who are subscribed to my podcast, many thanks for doing so. For those of you who have not, just hit the subscribe button right now so you never miss a new upload. I do have to apologize for the background noise. You're going to hear quite a bit of it, and the reason is because where I am right now, the local, I guess you would call, New Year is happening. One of the various forms of New Year. Here it is the Festival of Lights, and therefore the locals are celebrating with happy noise, which they do pretty frequently and pretty loudly, unfortunately. Not a whole lot that can be done about it, so if you hear a lot of explosions in the background, well, that's nothing to be alarmed about, that's just fireworks. So it makes for interesting times when you're trying to relax late at night, and it sounds like there's a bloody disco party going on in 3 out of 4 points of the compass, which is roughly speaking, exactly what's happening, actually. And what you'll typically get is a lot of fireworks going off and people with loudspeaker systems. It's not as bad, I'm told, as in previous years. I've never stuck around for that sort of nonsense in previous years. But for the most part, it is apparently much worse because everybody just goes, or used to go, nuts. But nowadays, I believe the police are enforcing noise regulations, so you can't just party all bloody night long, which is useful. I will say this about the local folks around here. I mean, not bad people, not exactly, but they do not understand how to celebrate quietly at all, and never have. So just a fair warning for those of you, my American listeners in particular, who insist that it is a good idea to import hordes and hordes of foreigners into your country. Just be aware that most of them are not quiet, not particularly civilized by your standards, and not interested in observing your norms of politeness and decency, because to them, if something needs to be celebrated, it needs to be celebrated loudly. So, that digression aside, I need to open by thanking one of my readers, Pat. Goes by the handle Pat himself. He gave me some very valuable instructions and pointers on how to use Audacity, which is the recording software that I'm using here on my Linux Mint laptop to do this podcast with you. He provided me with some really good advice, and hopefully that will allow the sound to be a little bit cleaner this time around. The aim is to get better with every iteration of this podcast so that you guys get the a high-quality experience out of it, and it doesn't just end up being me talking into a scratchy microphone the whole time. So, with that in mind, today I want to talk about, as I mentioned earlier, resiliency, pain, testing, and how you respond to these, the tests that you face in life. And I want to begin, I'm going to basically go through some of the things that have happened to me over the past year and a half or so, and explain to you what impact that has had on me and how that's affected me personally and affected my beliefs. Because the reality is that the last 18 months have been the toughest I have ever experienced. I mean, I've never been through a period in my life that was this hard. And I also want to try to explain to you some of the ways in which I kind of, I wouldn't say necessarily made peace with it, but at least came to accept some of the lessons that I was taught and how those lessons improved and changed my life. With the goal of helping those of you who are going through similar troubles similar problems, to understand and accept what's happened, and to use that as fuel to build yourselves up, to motivate yourselves, and improve your lives wherever you possibly can. So, to give you, for those of you who listened to the last episode of, the very first episode of this podcast, you will know something of my background, how I lived and worked in the U.S. for 12 years, and am basically very much a westernized Western person. I am a Western civilizationist and a nationalist by nature, and a lot of that transformation from sort of squishy centrist to sort of conservative to, well, not conservative, libertarian-ish, to what might have been called paleoconservative to hardcore nationalist happened because of what I observed in the U.S. during my time there. But while I was there, I mean, I was in a very, very good situation in life, particularly between 2015 and late 2017. So, you know, April 2015 to, I would say, November 2017, those 2.5 years were some of the happiest times of my life, the best times, because in April 2015, I received a long overdue promotion. I mean, I had been passed up for promotion twice, actually. I was up for the third time running, and if I had been passed up that time, I would have just left the company that I was working for, and I knew that was it. But in April, I was promoted one step up, and that came with a very nice bump in pay, which was the first big pay raise I'd had in about 4 years. So it was a huge deal for me, and it was a significant bump. It was like a 20%. More than that, almost 30% pay increase. And it was a really, really big deal because while salaries had not gone up after the great crisis of 2008 for a long time, living expenses definitely had, at least in the Northeast. So it was a great time for me personally and professionally. I had really stepped up my training in martial arts. I was in the best shape of my life. I was lifting heavy weights regularly. I was doing well in my training camps. And life was generally really good. And I'd settled into a very, very comfortable routine. I was living in Jersey City, which, for those of you who are not familiar with the Northeast United States, downtown Jersey City is a really nice area to live in, which is where I was. I was not far away from the harbor. And I was living in a really nice rented condo. Had pretty much everything I could have asked for, except for a significant other in my life, because you know I wasn't prioritizing that, and I wasn't interested in it too much because of the nature of American women, which for those of you who have tried dating American women, is horrible. It's awful. Anybody who's ever had to date American women in American cities has some idea of just how miserable an experience that is. And I tried it a few times, hated it, and just stopped for years on end. I just went into straight-up monk mode. But it wasn't doing me that much good. And what I realized looking back is that I was kind of getting stuck into a comfort zone. And I wasn't really moving. I wasn't growing in any way. I wasn't changing. I thought I was doing good work, but in reality, I was just getting too comfortable in one place. And when you get too comfortable, sooner or later, something comes along to kick you out of that comfort zone. Now, in my case, I'm firmly convinced that what happened to me was a lesson, a test. And it didn't happen by accident. It didn't happen due to random events. It happened because ultimately there is some sort of plan at work, some greater scheme, which required me to be tested in very difficult and very challenging ways to see what it was that I could take and to see whether or not I could handle what is going to come next. Because I believe that the challenges I'm going to face in the future are going to be much worse. So, to give you an idea of what I went through, I have to start by telling you how I lost my job. And this was the third job loss I'd suffered. In fact, every single job I've ever had since I graduated from university, I've lost. And, you know, one of my previous bosses likes to say that I am his new sort of bad luck charm, if you will. Anytime, I told him a few times that if I end up at a new company, short shares of that company, because within 2.5 years it'll be bottoming out. You know, it'll crash. And while there's black humor in that, it's also true. So I lost my job on March 20th, 2018. And the way it happened was this. I had been unhappy with my new boss for a long time. My manager had changed in about November of 2017. He's a guy I knew quite well before. He's a guy that I'd worked alongside for a long time. And while I was working with him, he and I got along great, because he was the guy who was very, very talkative, very energetic, but couldn't shut up. Yes, I know, pot, meat, cattle, but trust me, this guy was much, much worse than I have ever been. He just wouldn't shut up. He was the kind of guy where you'd walk into a meeting with him, and he'd book it for 15 minutes, and he'd end up talking for 45, and 40 of those minutes would be him jabbering away. So this is not the personality type that I do well with. This is the kind of personality that really annoys me, because I am the type that does well when I am presented with kind of clear requirements, offer my opinion, I'll give it very concisely and say, you know, here's your problem, you need to do X, Y, and Z to fix it, and here's how long it'll take, and here's how long I'll need to get it done, and here are the resources that I'll need, and then I'll just go and do it. With managers who understand that sort of approach, or who have that instinctive understanding of the technology, or at least know enough to get out of the way and let the smart people take over, that's a great manager to work for. And I've always thrived under people like that. I've never thrived under the talkative types who think by communicating rather than think and then communicate. So I've been looking to get out of from under this manager for a while. Now, I made a fatally stupid error, and I own this mistake. It's on me, and all of you are welcome to laugh at me for making it, but it's my mistake. I had approached the front office quant team and said, hey, I understand these books that you're trying to fix in the new system that you're trying to build really well, and I'd like to move over to your team and start working for you, because I'm not going anywhere in this role, and my skills are suited to you anyway. The head of that team looked me up and down, and he said, well, that's a tempting offer. I mean, no, you're not a programmer, no, you're not a hardcore mathematician or quant, but you know how to program in some languages. You at least know some language. You may not know C++ or Python directly. I did know some Python, actually, but at least you know something. And I said, yeah, I do. So he said, look, I'll come up with a compromise. You'll work with us in our front office team, but you'll sit in the headcount of your current division. And you'll split your time between us and your current work. And then if after 3 months or so we see that you make good progress, we'll talk about bringing you on full time. But you need to have a chat with your manager and let him know that you're thinking about this. Now, unfortunately for me, one of my biggest character flaws is the fact that I have great loyalty to people that I care about. And that sounds like a strange character flaw, but it's true. Because the reason why I stayed in my job, despite having a number of opportunities to move out and move up, or rather move away, was because I had very high loyalty to the people that I was working beside every day. I didn't want to leave them. I didn't want to abandon the line teams to do their thing. I wanted to make sure they were well taken care of. but I should have left. Because the reality is, and this is a lesson that I had to learn the hard way, very much the hard way, that nobody cares about you. Nobody cares how loyal you are in a big corporation, or in a small corporation for that matter. Nobody cares. Nobody gives a damn about you. People only give a damn about themselves. So when things go wrong, and people get fired, or people get laid off, they'll express sympathy for you. They'll say, oh, that's a real shame, you know, the company's done such a stupid thing, and so on and so forth. But every single one of them is going to be saying to himself, thank God that wasn't me. Thank God I still have a job. And I know this because I've been through multiple layoffs in several companies where I didn't get canned, but other people did, and I thought the exact same thing. Now, the reason why going to my manager and telling him about this arrangement, potential arrangement, was such a stupid idea was because I was there on a work visa. I was not there on a green card, which meant that if I lost my job, I lost everything. I was vulnerable, extremely vulnerable, and I showed my hand to a manager that I trusted because I had worked beside him for a long time. So I thought he had my back because he and I knew each other and we understood each other. I mean, yeah, he was a pain in the butt to work for and I didn't particularly like working for him, but I liked him enough as a person. I thought he was an okay, decent guy. What I did not factor for and what I made a really big mistake with was the fact that he was reporting into his managers who were not in favor of the function that I was doing. They didn't want somebody like me, technically skilled, savvy with the systems, working on the old systems. The entire bank was trying to move to a new platform, and I wanted in on that, but they wouldn't let me. And that was a major sign that I needed to get out, but I didn't obey it, or at least I didn't pay it the level of attention that I should have. So, picture how it all went down. Well, there I was on the morning of March 20th, and the previous day, Monday, March 19th, I believe, or maybe Tuesday, I forget exactly, but we had strict instructions to get in early. We needed to be in by, I think it was 8:30 a.m. for a global telecast. The CFO of the company was going to be doing a broadcast from, I think, either London or Germany, telling the entire company what we all knew was going to happen, what we all knew was likely anyway. He pointed out in several slides that while the company's performance was strong and things were going well with the turnaround and restructuring plan, which was like the fourth or fifth turnaround restructuring plan that the company had had in almost as many years, actually, things were going well, and yet the company was still chewing up 90 cents out of every dollar made in revenues because of its extremely high cost base, because of its extremely inefficient systems and its overburdened personnel and its extremely poor ability to manage trade transactions. So while its competitors had a cost to revenue ratio of, let's say, 65% to 70%, the company had a ratio of 90%, and that needed to go down. Now, whenever the CFO of a big company says stuff like that, you know it's coming. It means layoffs. I walked out of that global telecast thinking to myself, well, here we go again, because I had been through multiple rounds of layoffs, and I'd survived, and I'd done just fine. I knew where the layoffs were going to hit, or so I thought, and I knew that, or I thought, that I was going to be immune from them. But I was wrong. I was catastrophically and totally wrong. So I walked in the next morning, and I got in around about 8:15, 8:20, something like that. I like getting into work early. I've always been that way. And I sat down, had my cup of coffee, and surfed the web for a little bit, you know, caught up on news headlines, started checking through my emails, answered whatever I needed to, and started work. About 10 o'clock in the morning, I got a call on my phone. I looked down, and the caller ID was not registered, which was very strange. And I picked up the phone, and it was my manager. And he said, could you please come down to the 20th floor? And I said, okay. Now, I'd been laid off twice before. I knew what that meant. And that walk to the elevator was long and painful. It was the longest 2 or 3 minutes of my life getting down to the 20th floor like that, because I knew it was coming. I just thought to myself when I put the phone down, wow, that's it. 6.5 years gone. I'm done. They're going to can me today. Because you don't call up people from a different floor and tell them, come down here, to give them a pat on the back. That's not how it's done. You call them down to get rid of them. You call them down to sack them. So I got down there, and I walked into the room. It was a very fancy meeting room, because that's where the 20th floor of that building was where all the investment bankers would host their client meetings. So, you know, beautiful walnut paneling on all the rooms, and wood, beautiful finishes, paintings, and art, and decorations everywhere. Really nice place to be. So I walk in and I sit down. My boss is sitting on my right, and there are these two women sitting in front of me. One skinny, short Asian chick, and one ugly, fat Asian chick. A big, fat Asian chick. And my boss says, as you know, we are going through some cost-cutting measures, and your role with the company has now been eliminated. And these two ladies are from HR, and they will walk you through the process. And that was it. And he got up and left. And there was nothing about all of the times that I helped pull his team's ass out of the fire, nothing about all the late nights that I'd spent working to fix systems that were failing, nothing about all of the hard work that I'd put in over so many years, nothing about the sacrifices that I'd made, you know, in the summer of 2012, where basically I would be in on weekends working to fix all of the things that were going wrong, trying to rebuild spreadsheets and systems and processes, trying to fix things that nobody else could fix in my team, making the sacrifices that had to be made. Nothing about that. Didn't matter. Didn't matter to any one of them. He walked out, and I sat in front of these two women, and they just, the skinny Asian chick piped up, and she explained my severance package. And she explained my benefits, or quote-unquote benefits, that I would be getting. And she said, you're going to have to sign these documents and return them by a such and such deadline if you want your severance. And if you want to explore other roles within the company, here's a set of roles that match your skills, and you can apply to them through an HR connection that we have. And I recall thinking to myself, you know, how much I hate human resources. And I genuinely do hate HR as a function. It is an HR division in a company is the most dangerous and cancerous and lethal to productivity of any of them. Those who doubt me should read a book called Death by HR by J.B. Kennison, I think. I'll put a link to it in the description for this podcast. You guys can go read it. Very good book. Highly recommend it. The people in HR always think that they are the ones who should be running the company because they are the ones who manage personnel. In reality, they're just glorified pencil pushers. But they, in the litigation-fueled society of Western management culture, HR does play an essential role, but it's a horrible one. The line managers in most companies in the West are too chicken, too cucked out to do what needs to be done, which is to deliver blunt, in-your-face performance assessments and to have the guts to tell people you're not doing your job properly, or when the time comes to lay off people, I'm sorry, but we need to get rid of you. That's a function that line managers used to perform back in the day. That's not the case anymore. But the problem is that because companies are so afraid of getting sued, they need a middleman, and that's where human resources comes in. So they sit in on these meetings, and they're the ones who drop the axe. And it's a miserable job for them, but it's one that they're totally overqualified and in many cases unqualified to do. HR should never be given any role whatsoever in hiring or firing candidates in any way, shape, or form, other than filling out the paperwork of mandatory drug testing and crap like that. Under no circumstances should HR ever be given the power to interview candidates and, you know, ask them stupid questions like, what's your favorite color and what's your greatest weakness and all this other crap that they ask. These people are downright dangerous, and HR is the greatest entry vector that you will ever see in a company for SJWs to infiltrate and destroy a company. Under no circumstances should you give HR that power. If you have your own company, get rid of them as much as possible, outsource them wherever possible. So they get through explaining all this crap, and meanwhile, I'm just sitting there. I mean, I'm stewing with rage at this point. I am so angry. But there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can lash out at. There's nothing I can say to fix this situation, because it's over. 6.5 years of my life, gone. You know, all of that work, all of that effort, destroyed. And I walk out, you know, they ask me if I have any questions. I said no. I walk out of the room, and short, skinny bitch says to me, we need your ID card. Took it out of my wallet. Didn't even give it to her. Just tossed it onto a little table next to me. And it bounced off the table and it hit the floor. And I turned around, turned my back to her, and walked away. My former manager at this point was there, standing there with my stuff, my coat, and a folder and a few personal items that I'd requested from my desk. And he escorted me out down to security at the lobby, and walked into the lift, and he turned to me and he basically said, your personal effects will be sent to you over the coming days and weeks. Now, I didn't say anything to him. I didn't trust myself to speak. I would have very happily, you know, reached out and just punched him or strangled him at that point. I could have very happily done that. And it took tremendous restraint to stop myself from doing it. Mostly because I knew I was on camera, and just wouldn't have changed anything. So he waved me through the security turnstiles. I just walked out, turned left, and at this point it was about 11 a.m., 10:45. I walked to the train station that I took to get to and from work every day. And went back to my apartment, walked in through my front door, made a cup of tea, called up my dad, and told him I had to tell him that for the third time I'd lost my job. And it was a brutal, terrible phone call for me. I mean, he didn't criticize me, he didn't comment. You know, he was just shocked, but he just tried to give me whatever encouragement he could, and I think I spent the rest of the day playing video games, because I just wanted to be away from that world. I didn't want to be in my world. I wanted to be in someone else's world for a little while. And I went to the gym in the evening, because, hey, no matter what, you gotta stay in shape, gotta work out. And in all honesty, the iron helps in situations like that, it really does. You need something to get your mind off of the pain and the misery. And the iron helps in that respect. And the next day, you know, I went to martial arts and beat up on my friends and got beaten up in the process. And it was good. You know, it helped temporarily ease the pain. But as bad as that was, what followed in the months afterwards was much worse, because the administration of his most august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of Mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, had changed the visa regulations and made it much, much, much harder for American companies to hire foreign workers on H-1Bs, which meant that trying to find a job in a similar company in the same sector was nearly impossible, because a number of them had simply said flat out, we're not going to hire H-1Bs anymore. We're not going to do it. We're not going to transfer H-1Bs at all. And that meant that because of the suddenness with which the visa regulations had been enacted, a lot of people like me were SOL, completely out of luck. And a lot of companies that were still accepting H-1s were suddenly spoiled for choice. It was very much a buyer's market at that point for them. And I did not have much time. I did not have the ability to stay in the U.S. long term. You know, it's just not, you can't do that because of the way the visa regulations work. And maybe in another podcast, I'll try to explain to my American listeners why this is so, because Americans, at least Americans born in America, take for granted the enormous privileges that their passports afford them. And perhaps it would be useful for them to understand just how lucky they are. But that'll have to wait for a little while. But I couldn't find a job at all. I could not do it. It was impossible. And I don't know how many places I applied to. It was well over 100. Every single one of them rejected me. For somebody who's used to living up to high expectations and who demands a lot of himself, that was brutal. I mean, that crushed me really badly. And it just beat me down, you know. And my family could see how painful it was for me. My dad flew over to spend a couple of weeks with me, and it helped a bit, but reality was, you know, he wasn't going to be able to do anything other than give me moral support, which he did. You know, he tried. But the reality, you know, he went back and he felt like he'd failed. And unfortunately he had, because what had happened to me was not something that could be fixed easily. What had happened was a complete failure to anticipate changes. And I own that. You know, that's my fault. Nobody else gets the blame for this. I don't blame President Trump. I actually support completely what he did. Even though it made my life a living hell, I support him. And I support the restrictions on Indian workers coming into the U.S., on Chinese workers as well. I think there should be more restrictions. But it didn't change the fact that by beginning of May, I came to the realization that it was over. My dream of living in the U.S., of getting permanent residency there, and eventually maybe even becoming a citizen one day, was over. It was done. And I had to pack up all my stuff and get out by the beginning of June. So, packed up my apartment, put all my stuff in storage, threw out whatever I didn't need or whatever I didn't want to keep, which was a lot, and packed up and flew out from New York City to, as it happens, Moscow, Sheremetyevo Airport. Now, I happened to have a Russian business visa at the time for complicated reasons I won't go into here. But I figured, well, you know, what the heck? I've got a one-year Russian business visa. I should use it. So I went to Russia for a week. I visited right at the height of the World Cup, actually, because I got there right as the Football World Cup had started. And I visited Moscow and I visited St. Petersburg in the summer, which was absolutely glorious. Loved every minute of it. I mean, I cannot recommend Russia highly enough. And then I flew out. And yes, for those of you who are curious, yes, I did meet Russian girls Yes, I did go out on dates. Yes, it was a lot of fun. Russian women, I recommend over pretty much every other woman anywhere on earth. They have their own issues, but trust me, they're worth the time and the effort. So, I flew out on the 15th and landed in the old country on the on the 16th and landed in the old country on the 17th. And I was just miserable after that for months and months. And while I had the opportunity and the funds and the time to travel, I did not find another job until December of 2018. I managed to get in touch with an old friend of our family's who hired me into his company, and that was, I thought, a fresh start. But that didn't work out either over time. It became clear that things were not going the way we expected, either them or me. You know, things just weren't working out. So I had to quit that too. And it, you know, when you face failure like that repeatedly, when you see all of your hopes and dreams crushed like that, time and time and time again, it does leave an impact. And those who say, oh, you can shrug it off, you can deal with that, you know, it's not so bad, you can move on. No. You're gonna take damage. You're gonna have deep scars, and I carry those scars with me. They are extremely deep, and they were extremely painful. So for those of you who are going through something like this, you know, something as painful as that, where you've lost your job, your future is completely uncertain, you don't know how you're going to provide for yourself, you don't know how you're going to provide for your family, you don't know where you're going to be, you have just seen everything you worked really hard to create and maintain just destroyed in front of your eyes in a matter of minutes, you know, what do you do in a situation like that? How do you react? How do you respond? Well, I'm going to try to give you some ideas from my own life, and I'm going to try to explain some of the mistakes that I made. But there was a blog post that I've written on the subject, and I'll link to a couple of blog posts about these things, these topics that I mentioned, in the description, one of which we'll go through in detail for those who want to read it, how I lost my job and some of the lessons that I learned, and another about how you move on from events like this. How do you accept what's happened to you? How do you accept a world that hates you and try to deal with it and try to recover from it? You'll notice, by the way, that while I'm speaking to you, I'm not really getting too emotional. And that in and of itself, believe me, is an astonishing achievement. Because there was a time, you know, as little as four or five months ago, where I couldn't talk about these things without getting extremely emotional and choked up. You know, when talking to my parents, like, I couldn't deal with what had happened. And it took therapy to fix it. And I know there are those of you who are going to listen to that and roll your eyes and say, oh, well, psychology doesn't work. Look, guys, I share your skepticism. I really do. I have an intense skepticism of psychology as a field of study and practice. I think it's full of a lot of complete nonsense, and I regard many of its practitioners as quacks, or worse. But, big but, the reality is that as any powerlifter or martial artist can tell you, your mindset has everything to do with your well-being. And if you can't change your mindset, you can't affect the way you react to the world. You can't do it. You're always going to be locked into feelings of despair and hopelessness. You're never going to push yourself to the next level. You know, people who do physiotherapy know perfectly well that a big aspect of physio is the psychological aspect. It's not enough if you had a bad injury just to do the exercises. You have to will yourself into believing that you're going to recover and you're going to be stronger than you were before. I know personally from my own family of people who have suffered from strokes. Not my immediate family, thank God, but, you know, mothers and fathers of immediate family members who suffered strokes and basically gave up. You know, they said, I can't do this. And they gave up. They gave up the recovery process. That's similar to what happened with me. I suffered catastrophic loss. And for a long time, I kind of gave up. I stopped fighting. I stopped striving to do anything. I just said, okay, this is it. You know, I'm done. I tried to apply for jobs. I tried to look at alternatives. I tried to, you know, think about other options, but none of it appeals to me. None of it interests me. I mean, what's the point? What's the point in, you know, working for a system that hates me? What's the point in going back to school and getting another degree just to rejoin the corporate rat race, to make the same exact mistake all over again, to line myself up to be shot again by another company that hates me, by another bunch of shitheads who couldn't care less about me, who just see me as a resource to be used and thrown aside. What's the point in trying to make myself better? What's the point in struggling? What's the point in fighting? Why not just, you know, take the money that I've earned and relax for a while and see the world and do some of these things that I've always wanted to do? And that is exactly what I did for a while, for quite a while. I still had hope in the back of my mind that, you know, something was going to work itself out. I mean, I'd been communicating with people about a potential opportunity. I won't go deep in the details about that, but it's still a year and a half after I started talking to these guys, still pending. Nothing, at least that I have seen, has happened. But, you know, that's just because I don't see the stuff going on behind the scenes. And as the months dragged on and on, that hope began to fade a lot. And it really destroyed whatever little I had left in terms of confidence in my abilities. You know, 9 months to be out of work for 9 months for somebody who's worked continuously, more or less, since the age of 22, is devastating. I mean, you lose a lot of skills. You lose a lot of motivation and desire to do anything. You just, you know, you kind of condemn yourself, resign yourself to, you know, waking up, surfing the internet, bumming around a bit, maybe going to the gym, eating, sleeping, reading, going to sleep, doing it all again. That's exactly what I've been doing for a long time, and it's miserable. It's a horrible existence. That's what it's like to be retired. If that's what it's like to be retired, I don't want to be retired. I don't enjoy it. I would much rather be busy. But what helped me overcome this was, I think, a four-step process, which I outlined in one of the posts that I'll link below. And the first step really is forgiveness. And this is the hardest step of all. If you've been through hell, and people have put you through hell, you're going to have to find a way to forgive yourself for the mistakes that you've made. And you're going to have to find a way to forgive them. This is hard. I have been laid off 3 times by 3 different companies. Every single time, my managers were there in the room to tell me that my job was gone. And these were people who didn't have as much to lose as I did. Okay, my previous boss was on an H-1B like me, but he was, you know, the management team's, you know, favorite butt boy. So they liked him a lot, and they wanted him to stay on, and they were convinced by his kiss-up, kick-down style of management, where, you know, he would always tell the senior guys what they wanted to hear, and, yeah, of course I'll deliver, of course we've got it covered, you know, et cetera, et cetera. everything's going to be great. It'll all be roses. And then when it came time to deliver, well, it was the guys below him who suffered because he would just promise absurdly stupid things. And he was very political in his dealings. But that being said, eventually I got to the point where I was able to get down on my knees and forgive him. What got me to that point? Well, if you need to do therapy, if you're in a similar situation, see a therapist. I'm not joking about this. See a psychologist if you can. Because it's not enough just to talk to friends or family about it. Your family is going to have a certain set of expectations on you that you're no longer going to be able to meet. And they're going to have their own prejudices and experiences to apply to that. I mean, my father, for instance, has never, ever been laid off in his entire life. He's had a successful career for 30-odd years. Never once did he ever lose a job. He had to let other people go, but he never lost his job. So he had no clue what it was I was going through. My mother had to give up her job many times to follow my father, you know, whenever we moved to a different country. But that's different. That's voluntary. Yeah, okay. I mean, you could say it's not great, but every single time she quit her job, it was because she wanted to quit. She always had a choice. She could have stayed and continued working or gone with us as a family. But in Asian societies, the wife just does not, you know, stay and the husband goes. That's not how it works. It's the husband's job to provide and the wife's job to look after the house. So, you know, that's what she did. And she gave up a lot, but she never had to lose her job involuntarily. And they could never relate to it. So they had no idea what it was, what kind of psychological torment it was. They could never quite understand what it did to me. And it made me a horrible person. I treated my family extremely badly for a long time. You know, I was miserable to be around. I was moody and I was cranky and I hated being where I was. I still hate being where I am, but, you know, I'm a lot lighter about it now. I was just unbearable. And in January of this year, I sat down with them and I, you know, because I recognized what I had done. And I'd really hurt them very badly in some of the things I'd done. And I asked them to forgive me. And I said, look, I'm really sorry that I've treated you guys so badly. Please understand that, you know, it's been very difficult for me for the last, 9 months at that point, thereabouts. My mood had improved significantly because obviously I had a job again. I was working. I had hope for the future, but as it turns out, that was a fool's hope. But that's another story. You know, I'm much lighter about that than I would have been some months ago. So forgiveness is the first step, and to get to that first step, you're going to need help. You're probably going to need professional help because your friends and your family will not be able to get you there. If you need to see a therapist, do it. It will take multiple sessions, and the way the therapy will work is the psychologist will force you to go over and over and over again in your mind the events that caused the trauma. And that's exactly what happened with me. I mean, I had to sit there and, you know, I got so sick and tired of telling my therapist, you know, what happened. And this therapist, by the way, was not somebody I sought out. This was somebody who I knew and pushed me and pushed me. And, you know, she was a therapist herself, and she pushed me repeatedly and said, you need to get this done. You're going to sit with me and do therapy. I was like, no, I don't want to do it. But eventually, you know, with enough pushing, she got her way. And actually, I'm glad she did, because it helped a lot. So I got to the point where I was able to relate what had happened to me without getting emotional and angry, which was a big deal. You know, it took a long time to get to that point. So once I got to that point, it was much easier at that time to kneel down and say to the Lord, I forgive you. And that concept of forgiveness is critical to Christianity, and only Christianity really has it. You're not going to get that from any other faith. For those of you who aren't Christian, maybe this doesn't make any sense to you, but trust me when I tell you, at some level you're going to have to forgive people. And it doesn't matter whether you pray to the Lord to forgive them, or you call them up directly and say, look, I forgive you for what you did. It doesn't matter how you do it, but you've got to do it. And more than that, you've got to forgive yourself for the errors that you made, because it's inevitable that when you get laid off, when you lose your job, it's absolutely unquestionable, inevitable, that you have made mistakes to get to that point. Because no company is going to fire people who are really productive, unless it's a sadistic, disgusting company like, let's say, oh, I don't know, the Devil Mouse. Whereas if you are in a healthy company and they lay you off, then, you know, it's something you did. There's something you did that went wrong. And even if you're in a seriously unhealthy company like I was, this was a company that announced earlier this year that they were going to shed 18,000 jobs over the next 3 years, and they shut down an entire global division earlier this year. If you're in an unhealthy company, they're going to find ways to get rid of people. They're going to have to. So accept the blame on yourself and forgive yourself for it. The next step is to be grateful for what you have. And that gratitude is incredibly important. It may not seem like you have much when you've lost everything, but that makes what you do have much, much more important. Be grateful for the things that you have, for your friends, for your family, for your loved ones, for the people who stand with you no matter what. And be grateful for the fact that you're still in the fight. Because remember that conflict is in the very air that we breathe, the very water that we drink, the very food that we eat. Conflict is inevitable. Conflict and pain and suffering are going to happen no matter what. So you might as well accept it, you might as well internalize it, and you might as well greet it with joy. Be grateful for the tests and be grateful for the fight, because the fight is what makes your life worth living. The next step after that is to find allies wherever you can. And you're going to find them in the weirdest places. I mean, in my own case, you know, when I explained what I'd gone through, I found people contacting me from places I'd never even expected. And they weren't just sympathetic, they were really understanding and they wanted to help. And that has given me hope. Maybe it's a fool's hope, maybe it's a fleeting hope, but it's hope nonetheless. But that's what you're going to need, because the best way to break a man's will is to give him hope and then take it away. But if you can find hope that's real and tangible, hold on to it, because that's what's going to get you through the darkness. The next step after that is essentially to take some time, if you need it, and do other things. Do things that you never would have thought of doing otherwise. You know, in my case, it was travel. I mean, I didn't like traveling before. I still don't, if I'm very honest. But I like traveling with people. And I found people to travel with. And I went and visited, you know, Turkey, parts of South Asia, the Middle East, Russia several times, many times. London, I was in London not too long ago, in fact. Various other parts of, Singapore, of course. I went to Singapore several times. Various other parts of the world where I hadn't been in a long time and really wanted to visit again. I was in Oman, you know, for a one-day sort of sea trip, which was great fun. It was very enjoyable. I was in Abu Dhabi and for one day during my time in Dubai. So you know, you've got, if you have these opportunities, take advantage of them, because you're not going to be able to do it later on. In my own case, you know, I'm thinking about going to Ukraine sometime early next, or after, you know, in spring next year, because I've always wanted to visit Ukraine, and one of my friends is there, Kyle Trouble, on whose podcast I appeared not too long ago. And, you know, of course, going back to Russia is a great dream of mine, because I love Russia, I love the Russian people, and I love being there. So I can't wait to go back once the winter subsides, because I can't stand the cold. So do these things when you have the time, because you're not going to later on. And last but not least, keep your skills sharp. Find new skills to occupy yourself. Understand that the corporations of this world see you as a resource to chew up and spit out. They don't see you as someone worth investing in. They see you as just meat for the grinder. And it took me a long time to realize that. So take whatever steps you can to fix that. If you're a foreigner with a shitty passport like me, look at other countries which have stupid immigration rules and take advantage of them if you can. I'm advising you to be very mercenary about this, because when you've gone through what I've gone through, even if you love and respect the United States, which I do, I mean, I could never do to the U.S. what a lot of people do, which is to come in illegally and have babies and, you know, take advantage of the welfare system. I could never do that to America, even though a lot of my friends would joke with me and say, yeah, you should do that. I said, no, I can't do it. It's dishonorable. The reality is that being honorable when it comes to these things is not going to get you anywhere. When you have to make certain decisions, you've got to make them quickly and ruthlessly. So if you don't want to do it in the U.S., and I don't advise you to do it in the U.S. because, again, I love America and I want America to be free and prosperous, then do it to other countries where, you know, they're kind of dumb about those things, and that's their problem. So I would go on at some more length, but I don't think anybody's got really any time for that. This is coming up on an hour as it is. So I hope this has been helpful for some of you who are going through hard times. But remember never to lose hope. Always forgive wherever you can. Be grateful for what you have. Hold on to the people who matter the most, because they're what's going to get you through this. Learn the lessons from what you've suffered as fast as possible. I am not a good example of somebody who learned those lessons quickly. I didn't. It took me a long time for some of these lessons to sink in, and I'm still learning them, and it's painful. But you're going to need to learn how to accept some of these lessons quickly and internalize the pain quickly and let go of the pain where you can, because dwelling on it is just going to drive you crazy. So you're going to have to learn how to grow and respond and move as quickly as possible. And if you have more questions about how I got over it, or am still getting over it, over these things, drop me a line. My email is in the description box. And let me know what you think. Let me know what you're going through. And perhaps on the next podcast, I will read out some user comments and provide some feedback. If, again, this is something that is of interest to you. Otherwise, I'll just find something else to talk about, because Lord knows I have plenty of subjects on my mind. So that is all for this episode of Didactic Mind. I hope you enjoyed it. Please hit the subscribe button if you have not hit it already. Follow my podcast. Sign up to my blog for the regular emails so that you are always up to date on all of my writing. And I will see you on the next one.